Sue Wilson, would you continue with the presentation of yesterday?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Wilson. I am administrator of the Human Resource Services Division in the Department of Administrative Services. And I think yesterday we ended on page 31 of the slides, which was starting with our 10% reduction options. And in approaching these 10% reduction options, we looked at these in a similar way that we did to the prioritization list that I talked about yesterday, in looking at programs that could be picked up or shifted to agencies if we needed to, or looking at whole programs rather than taking taking some programs down to the point of which they become ineffective to run. So some of the things that you'll see in this 10% list actually take whole programs instead of just picking away at them. The first reduction that we have is the elimination of the centralized administration for the Employee Suggestion Award Program. That's a 0.5 FTE. And this is a program that exists under statute. There is a commission associated with it, and agencies could continue certainly to accept and work through employee suggestions. The second elimination option that we have eliminates some specialized recruitment services to the agencies. This relates mostly to coordination of internships and mentoring opportunities within the state, and also support for executive recruitment opportunities. The result would be that agencies would need to be coordinating their own internships and would probably take a little longer to complete some of the executive recruitments that we're involved in. The third reduction eliminates administrative support for the statewide technical training unit, which is the element of our training group that does computer training and technical training. This, again, would simply shift to other administrative staff, the registration, the billing, those types of things, and would probably result in timeliness issues. The same for the next position, which, although it says eliminate management of statewide technical, it's actually the business support position. It's not a management position. That, again, would have to shift to other staff. We would have to work within the Department of Administrative Services, most likely, to find assistance with billing and invoicing and contracting for the technical services. The next, in essence, eliminates the entire centralized recruitment service. We currently have three FTE. These are the people who are helping agencies do recruitment, those who don't have recruiting staff of their own, and also assisting with difficult recruitments. Taking one or two FTE from a program like this begins to make it really ineffective. So we said the policy decision is, should there be centralized recruitment or shouldn't there? And this would, in essence, eliminate centralized recruitment.
A question. Have you considered using the employment services, employment department?
Mr. Chair, we do work with the employment department currently, and, in fact, we're working on some additional programs right now. This is actually, we can get into their systems, but they don't provide full recruiting services in terms of newspaper advertising and those types of things. They have a different operation base than we do in actually going out and recruiting for staff. But we do work with them in getting our jobs onto, getting them onto their systems. And the last reduction is an administrative support position for the division in general. Again, some general office functions would simply have to be shifted more to some of the professional and technical staff, again, relating most likely with timeliness and response issues. Those are our reduction options.
Any comments or questions? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hartwig.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Hartwig. I'm administrator of the State Services Division within the Department of Administrative Services. This division is a consolidation of the Risk Management Division and the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division. This division provides services to all state agencies and other local governments. This consolidation enables these programs to better integrate in the provision of services to customers. Each share many of the same customers, are concerned about the same potential loss to the state resources, and provide policy and consultant guidance to state agencies and others to support sound business decisions. Our program overview, the division has four program sections. Risk management manages liability and property claims involving state insurance coverage. It receives and manages nearly 3,000 liability and property claims annually, provides funding to defend and to pay claims made against the state, and partners with agencies to identify and assess risk, develop and implement processes to manage and monitor risk to support agency operational missions. The State Procurement Office implements statutes.
What kind of a reserve fund do you have for paying claims? I notice in the paper there are several fairly large, up to $500,000, I think, in total.
The insurance fund is made up of primarily three components for three exposures: liability, property, and workers' compensation. We are fully funded through the insurance fund in the establishment of our reserves. The reserves are affirmed every other year by an actuarial analysis. That's every even year. And every odd year, we have a staff person that updates those actuarial information about the amount of reserves needed and expected monies for claims to be paid. So we're fully insured. The statute requires the fund to be actuarially sound, and we strive to do that by doing the actuarial analysis and then incorporate that in our chargeback allocation to departments for each biennium.
Amount? May I?
Yes.
Is there an amount of dollars that is... What's the amount of dollars? Or do...
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, I need to confirm with you this number, but I believe the current insurance fund stands at $70 million at this moment, but I need to get back to the fund.
Okay, that, yeah. Thank you.
The State Procurement Office implements statutes governing state purchasing and contracting, develops and administers rules regarding purchasing and contracting, and is the purchaser of goods and services for state and local governments. Statewide Fleet Administration establishes statewide fleet policies, coordinates all state agencies for meeting Environmental Protection Agency standards for alternative fuel vehicle purchases, implements cost-effective sustainability initiatives and management of alternative fuels. Surplus Property manages the central disposing of state and local government excess property, coordinates transfer of state and federal property for use by governments and nonprofit organizations. Our customers are all state agencies. They're able to participate in a centralized programs providing guidance and value-added services. Customers also include cities, counties, school districts, law enforcement organizations, and special districts. Customers may access online procurement services through the State Procurement Office. They may acquire law enforcement equipment, state and federal excess property through surplus property. They may obtain cost-effective vehicle leases through statewide fleet services. The residents of Oregon may purchase excess state and local government property sold by surplus.
What's the status of the airplane availability? I mean, the state owned at least three planes, I understand, and they got rid of maybe one. Do they still have one for traffic, and do they have one for fish and wildlife? Or?
Chair, Senator Morissette, I would need to follow up with you. My understanding is that there are two airplanes, but I need to confirm that and get back with you about where they are and affirm the count.
Chair?
Yes.
Forestry has two aircraft. State police have two remaining aircraft. They had four. They sold the two large aircraft. They have two smaller aircraft for traffic.
And two for the forestry?
Forestry has two, yeah.
Good, thank you.
Thank you.
I forgot that you were among your many other interesting.
Yeah, jack of all trades, yeah. Senator.
Continue, please.
Follow up on page 8. Other customers are suppliers and businesses. They seek business opportunities that are posted by the state procurement office. They bid on state contracts, and they sell to state and local agencies through our state contracts. Nonprofit agencies are also customers. They obtain surplus property. They purchase from our state contracts, and they sell products and services of the disabled to state and local agencies through our state contracts.
Please go ahead. Do we still list on eBay? And if so, what?
Senator Morissette, we still list property on eBay. The reason we do that is we found that to be an effective way to sell property quickly, and we think we get a good price for the property on eBay. And we've had relatively few problems selling through eBay. It's become a primary source for us to dispose of property. And so we've used it. If you'd like information.
Does that include vehicles from the motor pool? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, David, percentage of surplus property that gets sold through eBay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I'm not sure what that is. I need to get back with you. It's a fairly large percent,
okay.
But I'll get back with you on that.
That's great. Thank you.
Regarding the history of the divisions, I'm going to go through with you the transition that's occurred for the divisions. Beginning in the biennium 1979-81, the Risk Management Division was formed. In biennium 1989-91, the Transportation and Distribution Division was formed. Then in the biennium 1995-1997, Transportation, Purchasing and Print Services was formed. This was a combination of transportation and distribution. The purchasing division, which at that time included surplus property, the printing division, and then two components of what was then the services division, and that was mail processing and the motor pool programs. In 2003-2005, the print services program, including state mail processing, was transferred to the Information Resource Management Division within the Department of Administrative Services. This left procurement, surplus property, the Motor Pool Fleet Administration remaining in what was named then Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services. In March of 2004, Surplus Property, State Motor Pool joined the Facilities Division. And the State Procurement Office became aligned with the Director's Office in the Department of Administrative Services. In July of 2004, Surplus Property, the Motor Pool Fleet Administration, State Procurement Office, and the Division of Risk Management were combined to create the new Consolidated State Services Division. This shows the development and transition of the divisions. Programs for transportation, distribution, purchasing, print services, mail, and motor pool have continually evolved since 1989-91. The consolidation in July resulted in merging what at times over history has been up to 5 separate divisions, and now most of those activities are in one. The new division combines programs with enterprise-wide, centrally managed responsibilities. Each has mutual interest. For example, we all want to assure proper contracting. We want to assure safe operation, proper utilization, and maintenance of fleet vehicles. And we want to assure the protection of state surplus personal property.
Tell me a little bit more about the alternative fuel vehicles that you purchase. Are they a combination of natural gas and gas vehicles that they can switch back and forth, or are there other types of alternative fuel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, there are, I'd say, 3 different types of vehicles that utilize what we would term an alternative fuel. One are vehicles that are powered by compressed natural gas. Others are what are referred to as hybrids, which would be like the Toyota Prius, which is a combination of gas and battery powered. And the third would be vehicles that utilize E85 fuels, which is a blend of ethanol and gasoline. So we have 3 different types of vehicles there in various numbers, and they are placed in different places throughout the state. Most of the compressed natural gas vehicles right now are in Portland and Salem, because in Eugene lacks a distribution point at the moment for compressed natural gas.
Sure. David, could you get us some statistics on exactly how many alternative fuel vehicles the state owns?
And
the breakdown on that? And secondly, do you have any concept about how many gallons of fuel the state goes through in a year statewide? I'm talking ODOT, motor pool, any organization, forestry, for all fuel purchases, period, in terms of both diesel, gasoline, and the prices of those fuel purchases in terms of average prices, and also for the alternative fuels. Ethanol, what are we paying for ethanol? What are we paying for CNG? Are we using biodiesel, and what are we paying for that biodiesel? Those types of things would be very helpful if you could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, we can do that. We have begun some work on doing that analysis, and I can bring that back.
That'd be outstanding. Thank you.
I wasn't going to ask you for that kind of detail. But I'm interested. One of the interesting things, though, is the all public vehicles, I understand, are exempt from paying the gas tax. Is that true? I think ODOT is exempt now from paying a gas tax. You buy the gas. Could you check on that and let me know for sure? Because I know that there's. I believe there should be a user fee in lieu of, but I guess there's some objection to a tax organization having to pay a tax. It's kind of a circular thing, but some of the heaviest vehicles do not pay a gas tax. The school buses and other public vehicles don't do that. They tear up the roads. So
similar to us, I guess it's a state not paying property taxes either.
Yeah, it makes
similar
sense
concept.
That they don't, but it's still. I think everyone should contribute to the maintenance of highways some way if they use the highway, a user fee of some kind in lieu of it. So,
a question for staff. Dallas, are we going to be coming back in greater detail in these areas in future hearings? What's the anticipated schedule? Because I can see a number of things that would be important to be discussing in greater detail than we would hear from you this morning.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you're starting to go into phase 2 questions with costs and expenditures and the like, which we will be doing. We don't yet have a schedule for phase 2. It's supposed to start sometime in March, where we get into the budgets, and we will keep track of these requests. The chair will review them with the co-chairs. We're trying to get the information together so that we'll have them available for use. Yes, the answer to questions, and we'll be giving them the details of the budgets in the next phase.
So with respect to issues like the strategic purchase in the Silver Oaks, we'll have an opportunity to come back in greater detail to examine how that is working.
Right, the benefits from that, the costs and cost, as well as savings, yes.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to missions and goals. I'm on page 15. I think that corresponds with your material. Our mission is to provide value-added risk management, procurement, fleet, and surplus services that enable state services and state agencies to accomplish their public mission. You have listed by reference the statutory authority for each of the programs. We have numerous goals within this division. We develop knowledge, skills, and effectiveness of state agency advisors and risk coordinators to identify and minimize risk. We provide basic and advanced training to key agency managers and staff on safety and risk management. SAFE is an important partner in regard to training and workers' compensation issues. We manage the cost of litigation effectively and efficiently. We're creating teams that include the Department of Justice and respective agency to manage high-profile, high-cost tort claims and litigation. We partner with agencies to develop and implement efficient processes to make sound business decisions. We've established tools and processes for incident analysis and risk analysis as essential elements for making risk-adjusted business decisions. We create centralized processes and policies and streamline core services for state agencies. Centralized purchasing of insurance, goods, services, and vehicles assures enterprise consistency and attains best value for our purchase dollar. We assist suppliers and public agencies in effectively conducting business through value-added online procurement environment. Online procurement is available through the Oregon Procurement Information Network. State agencies, local governments, and vendors can jointly track and respond to requests for goods and services. We provide procurement leadership and services for innovative, responsive, and accountable procurement. And we create an outcome-oriented procurement environment based on innovation, measured performance, cost-effectiveness, and public accountability. We manage state fleets under DAS authority to attain an operating cost of 18 cents or less per mile. We've developed a new rate model based upon actual cost of doing business. It is a chargeback model as recommended by Biennium Fleet Review. The rates are integrated with policy package requests that you'll discuss at a later date. The new rates are a reduction of 36% overall with a projected reduction in costs of $7.3 million across all agencies.
Mr. Chair? Yes. When you're talking about managed fleets and attaining the operating cost of 18 cents a mile or less, can you provide us with some information about how that compares with private, the operating costs of, say, renting vehicles from Avis or Hertz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I have some information later that will touch on that. I'm not sure it'll be, maybe might not be the details that you want, but I will make a reference to that later.
Okay.
Where we've done some analysis.
Then we'll take a look at that in round two. Thank you.
Actually, I think that'll be the day. I'll make a reference to that.
Okay.
The corollary question to that, David, would be, does the 18 cents include ownership costs, or are those just strictly variable costs?
Chair, yes, it does. It's all costs.
Thank you.
Thank you. These sound like performance measures. I don't see performance measures. These are goals and missions, but they could be performance measures. Did I miss something?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, performance measures are coming. They're at the later part of the material here.
Oh, okay. I just kind of looked through and I didn't see it, but these, at least, yeah, okay. Thank you. I'll wait.
We regularly review the size of fleet based upon utilization and make adjustments in response to use patterns. We to seek ways to partner with private sector to provide alternative fuel usage and vehicles. I mentioned earlier that there's not currently a compressed natural gas distribution center in Eugene. We're working with a private distributor who has plans to develop a site that's within a mile of our motor pool in Springfield. And so we're working with them and expect that to proceed, and then that will enable us to transfer some of our compressed natural gas vehicles to Eugene since they're limited in range. But then when they're in Eugene, they have fueling capability in Eugene, Salem, and Portland, so it gives us a much broader use through the valley of using those compressed natural gas vehicles.
Is this a private contractor that you use otherwise? Is it Pride? Or do you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore said it's not Pride. It's a separate private company, and the name escapes me at the moment. The other goal for Fleet is that we provide fleet management services to agencies without authority to own fleets to improve their cost-effectiveness, maintenance, and fuel accountability. Next, I'm moving to the organizational charts, which begin on page 21, I believe. The first chart there reflects organizational structure and positions of the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division. The next slide refers to the Risk Management Division organizational structure and positions. And the third chart indicates the organizational structure and positions resulting from the consolidation of Procurement, Fleet, Surplus Services, and Risk Management to create the new Division of State Services. Moving to programs and services, starting with risk management. Risk management provides statewide direction and leadership to state agencies to prevent loss of resources, to utilize policies, procedures, training activities, and consulting services to help prevent loss. Provides self-insurance coverage for state property, which is valued at $7.5 billion. We purchase an excess property policy of $400 million, which is above retention level of $1.5 million. Except for earthquake and flood, the retention level is $4 million. We provide self-insurance for liability coverage for state employees, officers, and agents acting within their scope of duties, and purchase and manage workers' compensation coverage for state employees through SAFE. The State Procurement Office acquires goods, services, personal services, and public improvements for state agencies under DAS authority, establishes statewide value-added discounted price agreements for goods and services commonly used by state and local governments. We've initiated strategic sourcing, which we will come back and talk with you about at another time. We train and certify state government purchasing officials in Oregon regarding public purchasing requirements. There's 120 certified Oregon basic procurement officers in state government that have been trained by the State Procurement Office. State Procurement also provides the Oregon Procurement Information Network, which is a web-based procurement system serving suppliers and public agencies. Currently, 100 agency boards and commissions subject to DAS authority participate in that network. 385 local government school districts and the university system participate, and over 2,000 suppliers have signed up to participate in that system. Procurement Office also develops policy and guidance to state agencies regarding contracting performance and purchasing. For State Fleet Administration, we provide 3,700 general purpose vehicles to state and local agencies. Most are permanently assigned. Some are used for rental purposes. This number is down from 4,000 vehicles in the last biennium. We might maintain and service vehicles, dispense fuel, coordinate all state-owned vehicle activity, coordinate fleet consolidation and realignment, manage alternative fuels and alternative vehicles, operate three state motor pools, Portland, Salem, Springfield, Eugene, and lead the biennial performance evaluation that's done on all state fleets on a each biennial.
I'm sorry. I think I was missing something when you were talking about procurement. Did you have numbers for the statewide value added? You mentioned state and local. If you do, I'd like to have. I don't see them listed.
No, they're not listed.
Okay, if you could, if we could have those numbers, I'd appreciate it.
Question is the volume.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Down by units of government.
Yes.
Okay.
Excuse me. You're talking about local governments participating in the procurement. Is that correct? Yes. Okay. And you did give some figures, and I was not looking at the part that you were dealing with at the time, and I would like to have those numbers.
Here, Senator Morissette, we can provide those to you. Regarding surplus property activities within the division, they lead the reutilization of surplus property by public agencies, nonprofits, and the general public, develop a disposal policy and guidance for the sale of state personal property, locate, screen, and assign federal surplus property to state and local governments and qualified nonprofits, and conduct public sales of non-donated federal excess property to the public.
The qualified nonprofits, I don't understand that. If you could provide additional information at some point, I'd appreciate it.
Moving to key performance measures, the division has 12. The first one starts on page 35. This first slide is an attempt to denote the annual number of claims for workers' compensation, liability, and property per 100 FTE. Our goal is to have the combination of those claims be under 10 per FTE. And as you can see, for 2002, 2003, and 2004, we have been under that goal. The outlier for this, really the component of activity that most impacts this, is workers' compensation medical-only claims. They're the highest count. And that's why we set our goal at 10, not knowing how that might go. The other three areas, workers' compensation, liability, and property claims, don't tend to have the frequency in the number of claims.
Excuse me, David, is this just for within your department, or is this within all branches of government?
Here, this is statewide.
Statewide.
Okay, thank you. And I'm assuming that what you are doing is making sure that there are safety notices and people are aware of procedure in the workplace, the way that you reduce the claims.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, we have a rather extensive organization involving agency safety and risk coordinators. Our safety and risk unit within that program meets quarterly with those individuals. We provide annual training in workers' compensation, and we have biennial risk management seminars for those individuals.
An additional question, David. Are you tracking the workers' comp issues with respect to the Home Care Commission?
Mr. Chair, I would say that we're tracking as an interested bystander, not as a participant.
Could you explain the way that contract is structured with SAFE? It's because I understand SAFE will not quote a rate after June 30th of 05.
Chair, I don't have knowledge of that contract that the home health care workers have with SAFE. I couldn't comment on that.
That then does not function or to flow through DAS, but it goes through DHS directly?
DHS, or? Mr. Chair, has responsibility of managing that program, and we do not.
Is that program somewhat of an anomaly in the way that workers' comp is provided?
If I may, Mr. Chair, and I will preface by saying I am not the expert on this matter in any way, shape, or form either. My understanding, however, is that this is a unique situation because home care workers have been classified as not state employees. I mean, they're not really a state agency or state employees in the way that David and I, for example, are here sitting in front of you, so they don't fall under the auspices of other risk management issues like the rest of us sitting here today would.
Well, who then is managing, is responsible for the risk management for this group of 13,000 to 14,000 employees? It's a pretty dramatic impact.
My understanding is that it's the Home Care Commission itself, and then there are some unique structural issues with relationship to the Department of Human Services, and I think there are some there's an attempt to clarify some of those relationships this session, and again, I'm not the expert on it, so I don't want to lead you down a road that I don't have all the facts behind, but I think you need to bring in some other folks that could respond to that more directly.
It's outside the purview of this committee, I suspect, DHS and Human Services.
The measures on page 35, do those pertain to claims filed or claims accepted? Meaning, there are many, especially in workers' compensation, many claims that are filed and not as many that are accepted, and I don't know what your goal pertains to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Botkin, these would be claims that have been accepted on the workers' compensation side.
That raises a whole other question that I didn't really want to get into, is what kind of motivation is there to reject claims to meet your goals?
I wasn't throwing up the ball for you, Senator.
Yeah, I know, Michael, but I have
to start swinging.
That's another issue which I will investigate.
Another day.
Okay. Please proceed.
The next slide is on page 36, and it compares the rate for last year, 2004, to past rates regarding workers' compensation time loss claims for 100 FTE. It indicates a very slight increase in the number of time loss claims. We're watching this to determine whether or not a new trend is developing. It's important because nearly 85 to 92% of agency workers' compensation costs are related to time loss claims. So it's something we want to pay attention to. We've initiated a revitalization of the statewide safety initiative, which had been ongoing since 1987. We're meeting with representative agency heads to update and refresh the initiative elements. The focus on the safety initiative recognizes agency cost increases due to the spend down of workers' compensation surplus funds. During biennium 05-07, agencies will receive an allocation reflecting the full cost of workers' compensation for the first time in nearly 12 years.
Do you have a sense of what that aggregate total will be? In the aggregate, you say they will not be accepting the full charges. In the aggregate total, do you have a sense of how much that will be?
Mr. Chair, it was part of the price list that was developed by the Department of Administrative Services, and as my memory serves, I want to say it's the cost of workers' compensation for the next biennium will be $37 million, but I probably should confirm that and get back with you.
An incremental increase?
Oh, an incremental increase, Mr. Chair. For example, this biennium, agencies were allocated $14.2 million while we spent down the rest of the surplus funds. So the increase from 14.2 to 37 million would be what agencies would C for 0507.
I guess I'd like to get on the record. I'd like information about the number of claims filed and the number of claims accepted. And whenever that is available, if that's part two. Okay, good, thanks.
Next slide on page 37 is focused on general liability costs, and it compares the rate of loss for year 2004 to past rates. The graph shows claims over $500, claims paid of $500 or more per 100 FTE. While the number of general liability claims have remained stable, we're seeing an increase in the cost of these claims. And we believe that the increase in cost is primarily driven by higher severity in three types of claims: employment, civil rights, and medical malpractice. Our next performance measure.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
How does the medical malpractice claim relate here to the state? Where do we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Botkin, the primary place where we see this is at the Department of Corrections, where they provide medical services for inmates.
Do any malpractice claims through OHSU apply to these statistics, or are they not considered part of the state database for these statistics?
Chair Representative Botkin, they're not included and not considered state claims.
Okay, thank you. I understand that OHSU, because they are associated with the state, are they immune from malpractice suits? I have a constituent who claims they are.
Chair Senator Morissette, OHSU is not immune, but they're not considered part of the state family, organizational structure. The next performance measure is in relation to auto liability. You can see that there's been quite a downward trend in this area. This reflects agencies effectively instituting the Vehicle Incident Prevention Program. This program focused on agencies that had the most exposure, and the exposure criteria at the time was having 10 or more incidents, which was either collisions or citations, and having driven more than 1.5 miles, and an incident rate higher than the state average, or more than $150,000. Agencies are expected to assure that employees have current licenses and acceptable driving record, and it's expected that agencies will investigate each collision, each citation, and each citizen complaint to analyze the cause, identify corrective measures, and put together preventive methodologies. The next slide is specific to property insurance. And again, it gives a historic perspective of the rates per 100 FTE. You'll see a significant drop-off from 02 to 03 and 04. And this is primarily the result of an increase in the deductible for agencies. In July of 2003, the deductible increased from $500 to $2,500 unless the agency had 20 or fewer FTEs. And in that instance, the deductible was $1,000. And the reason that risk management did this is that it was anticipated that we could reduce the allocation back to agencies $4.4 million per biennium. We're keeping in contact with agencies to see if this is a burden on them in regards to having to pick that up, get some indication as to what the financial impact is for them. But at the moment, we're not receiving negative comments from agencies due to this increase in the deductible. And again, it reduced the allocation back across all agencies by $4.4 million. The next slide indicates that we've successfully met, at least in 2003, our goal of customer satisfaction of at least 80%. We're awaiting responses from the 2004 survey. We don't know what that will tell us, but we're optimistic that it'll tell us the same thing as it did for 03. Next slide was
Mr. Chair, could you tell us who the respondents are? Who did you poll in order to get this data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Botkin, as I remember, we polled all of the safety and risk coordinators that we work with in agencies, and we would have also included other specific representatives that we may have worked with on a particular claim. So the pool was primarily people that we have regular working relationships and contact with. The next performance measure on page 41 was an attempt to denote change in current claims costs when compared to previous bienniums. The thought was that we might be able to predict costs between bienniums, and as you can see from the information here, there's wide divergence from 01 to 03 to what's projected for 2005. So at the moment, I believe we're being proven wrong, that we have an ability to predict how claims may vary from biennium to biennium. Our next slide is specific to state procurement. It examines prices in five high-use, high-volume product areas compared to prices that would be paid by state agencies if they didn't have the benefit of price agreements. State Procurement Office has a goal of saving at least 7.5% compared to prices paid by other entities obtained without a price agreement. This slide indicates overall savings amongst these five product areas when compared to General Services Administration prices. So you can see that we're paying slightly more for vehicles and cell phones, but less for computers, office supplies, and paper. And out of a total spending in 2004 of $42.6 million, we obtained reduced cost of 7.9%, or $3.6 million.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had a question that's bothered me for 4 years, and now's my chance to ask it. No, it's not a zinger question. How does the state procure periodicals, newspapers, magazines, etc.?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Been bothering you for 4 years.
I'm from rural Oregon. We've got a lot of little.
It takes longer
offices
to get up to speed when you're from rural Oregon.
This is a big issue for us.
I'll affirm this, but to the best of my knowledge, the bulk of the periodicals and publications are purchased by our agency-specific purchase. They have a particular interest in a type of periodical or publication that are unique to their operational mission. I'll affirm that, but that's my understanding.
Can I follow up? The reason this has been an issue is in my district, we have a lot of 1- and 2-person offices, and quite often when I go in there, I'll see 4 or 5 different periodicals subscribed to, and from my perspective, it tells me one of two things. Either, one, they're spending an awful lot of time reading and not working, or two, we got an awful lot of periodicals sitting around, and granted, it's $20 or $30, but if that's $20 or $30 multiplied times 300-400 offices, we might be able to pay a teacher's salary for 4 or 5 months. Anyway, I would like to know how that works.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, do these the figures you have for computers, does that represent all state computer purchases for 2004?
Chair, Representative, up to my knowledge, yes, it does. It purchased up to, I'm not sure the date certain on this, but I believe it was through June 30th of 04, but I would need to confirm that.
Okay. Does it include software, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I'm not sure of that, and what's confusing me is we've, through the new strategic sourcing effort, we've separated the specific hardware from software and other peripheral equipment. So I would need to get back and confirm that for you.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, if and to Dallas and also for DAS, when we get into presentations from IRMD, Teresa McHugh, when she was director of DAS, testimony this last interim before the House Government Oversight Committee, in response to a question in public hearing when I asked, do we know how much the state is spending in total for computers, software, communications, so forth? Her response is, we really don't know. Because I've heard numbers anywhere from $1 billion to $1.7 billion. And if you look at individual contracts that are vendor contracts that are let between agencies, there are large numbers of expenditures for software consultants, for computer hardware, and it adds up to a lot more than the $12 million that we're seeing here. It's a lot more. And if we're really spending $1.7 billion, what I need to know is if these are general fund dollars, if these are total purchases, if they're purchased some with federal dollars or other funds dollars, or if these are general fund, I'd like to see that broken down. And I just really think, Mr. Chair and Dallas, that we need a comprehensive look at how much we're spending in this state on communications infrastructure. And so far, no one has given us that. And I think it's critical that we do. I think it's long overdue.
Are you addressing communication or IT?
Well, I need to know if communications is rolled into IT, because I hear that it is in some cases and isn't in others. So I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means cell phones or total expenses for our telephone systems, calling cards, if that's all part of this supposed $1.5 or $1.7 billion in spending. Because I hear both ways. So I'm confused, and I'd like to know what the real expenditure is there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Acting Director for DAS. We'll have IRMD address this issue. They cover those areas, and David's group does the purchasing of those, but they're not knowledgeable enough in the areas that you're asking questions
in. Okay.
IRMD would be much better prepared, and they have addressed some of those issues in the interim with the JLCIMT committee, because those questions came up there, so they're probably prepared to do that tomorrow is when they're up.
Dallas, do you have any light to shed on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this comes up all the time, and as Ms. Warner said, IRMD is probably in the best position to respond to this because it has been tasked with inventorying the state's data processing and telecommunications. I think we have to segregate the infrastructure that the state has for telecommunications from those other things such as cell phones. That's not a part of the landlines and the like, but so they would be much better prepared to respond to that question.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, follow-up question. Who has responsibility? I'm assuming DAS and your management and oversight function. Do you have responsibility then for how the contracts are let, procurement, for these systems, vendor contracts, who RFP processes in terms of when you let out an RFP for a consultant on computers, and then who has responsibility to monitor the implementation of these contracts, and cost overruns, those types of things. And I'm asking this specifically because I'm hearing rumblings within state government that there is a particular very expensive system that is being procured right now that is already in a cost overrun circumstance. And I want to know who's responsible for it. I want to know how the system works here. Because if it's true, then I need to be able to know how we hold people accountable for that.
And are you speaking to IT or communication?
It is IT, yes.
IT. Yeah.
But DAS has the oversight, is my understanding. So,
but we have IRMD coming, which probably would be the appropriate place to drill down and with these questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the contracts, you're correct that DAS has the responsibility for the contract and the procurement side. The Department of Justice ensures all the legal aspect of those contracts, so there's dual review there between procurement people and Department of Justice on the configuration of the contract and deliverables and those types of things. Once the contract is executed, though, if an agency is buying services for IT professionals and those type of things, they are responsible for monitoring the deliverables and ensuring that they got what they ordered on time, on budget, to their specifications. Our staff does not do that.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'm not sure exactly which overrun you're speaking about, but
I hope there's not more than one.
We could have a side conversation about that if that would be helpful.
And that'd be fine if you'd like to. No, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Morris. I know at this level we're supposed to stay at the 30,000 foot level, but I have to take it down just a little bit further. Earlier I asked a question about the periodicals, and the reason I asked that question was I'm a firm believer that when you watch your nickels and your pennies, the dollars take care of themselves, just the way I've always been raised. And the question I have goes to the office supplies and paper. Has there ever been any type of analysis or study to determine what percentage of that leaves the state in the evening? I don't want to call it theft, but pens, papers, heading home. To a small business owner, that's a significant issue. To the state of Oregon with 44,000 employees, maybe it's not, but I'm just curious if anyone's ever looked at that to determine the type of money that would be going home in the evening.
Inventory control, in other words, is...
Yeah, and I want to follow up with that in a moment.
Chair Representative Smith, I'm not aware of any analysis that's been done on that aspect of behavior or inventory control. I could ask staff and follow up with staff, see if, what they're aware of. Each agency has responsibility for creating its own management processes and administrative controls, be it inventory for these types of supplies or equipment usage, what have you. So the agencies are diligent in how the processes that they have in place, and but I'm not aware of any analysis that's been done regarding that.
One last question.
One last question, then we need to be moving on because we've got a lot to do here, and we will adjourn at 10:30. So
I did.
Has there been any analysis to determine theft? I remember working at OHSU, young kid going through college, and I'll never forget watching a manager go up and take a huge, huge box of Pampers down off of a warehouse. I worked in the warehouse, came down and gave it to a lady who was going on maternity leave, walked right out the front door with it. And I never forgot that. And at the same time, I watched other people, if they needed a 12-pack of batteries, put the batteries in and out they walked. And I'm just curious, what level of theft occurs in
and supplies and processing. Do we have any type of analysis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not aware of analysis of theft at that level for that type of item. But again, I can follow up with staff and ask. But again, agencies have the responsibility for instituting inventory controls and managing the use of those kinds of supplies.
Who's over follow up? And I haven't asked any questions. I just want to really quick. Who follows up on the agencies? And who ensures that this stuff isn't leaving?
Chair Representative Smith, the agencies have internal auditors. The audits are conducted by Secretary of State's office, and that's one way that there is some accountability within the system. But again, agencies are responsible for having those processes in place to prevent that.
Raise a very good question. When you have an organization that has no ownership, the potential is there.
Well, if you're a small business owner, you're going to be concerned if 1-2% of your inventory is going out the door.
Right. different motivation.
I have a quick question about verifying that the local government agencies are part of the purchasing, right? Does that get all the way down to a volunteer fire department? The other thing is, I can buy a paper cheaper, which I do at Office Max, and I turn in the receipt here. So I can buy paper cheaper somewhere else than I can downstairs. So 7% is no big deal, apparently. The other suggestion is that, getting to Representative Smith's concern about magazines, that we save magazines and send them over to rural Oregon so they can use them in their office.
It would be faster than the mail.
And that would then save some money. And if they just want to show that they're informed, they can put these old magazines out and people would be impressed, including Representative
It would
Smith.
Be faster than the U.S. mail.
Or, Senator, we could go the other way. We could send them to the West. Let's continue. I see we have 40 minutes, and we have some major stuff yet to cover, so we need to hold the questions, I think, and allow us to proceed.
Mr. Chair, would it be of assistance to move to the reduction options rather than continuing with the performance measures, or
I think that would be a good idea.
Reduction options that the division has proposed, and there are 12 of them. They begin on page 51. When we looked at this, we determined that we did not have a group or a specific program area that we would be able to totally eliminate. We have some positions that we're eliminating that will impact our ability to do some of our functions, but we're looking at our business practices and operations to see if there's a way to address that. So you won't see whole activities such as safety and risk consulting or procurement activities that are being proposed to be reduced. On page 51, the first reduction option that is listed here would eliminate an accounting position in the state surplus program. The position has been vacant due to lack of cash flow, and so they would not determine that there would be a service level impact with that elimination. The next two items refer to the management of litigation and lawsuits. We've begun to implement a more assertive management claims process. We've established a criteria to identify claims with potential for high cost or exposure, and we're expanding the authority of adjusters to seek settlement of tort claims prior to a lawsuit being filed. I mentioned earlier that we've initiated coordination with Department of Justice and specific agencies to develop a management strategy for high-cost, serious claims. And we believe that this will enable us to make earlier decisions about whether or not we should settle or whether we should pursue a resolution through trial. So both of these are the next two reduction options are in anticipation of being able to reduce the our defense costs by a more assertive claims management process. On page 52, the next option would eliminate seven positions in the state motor fleet. These positions provide shop maintenance service that would negatively impact our ability to absorb any increases in providing maintenance service to vehicles from non-authorized fleets. We've begun negotiations with Department of Human Services and Department of Corrections to assume maintenance of their vehicles. We believe that we can provide that at less cost for them. We've had discussions with them. We're comparing our numbers with theirs, but we believe that we can give them more effective, more cost-efficient service, and that a reduction in these positions would impact our ability to do that. On page 53, the first option would be to eliminate primarily a support position that provides support for the Citizen Complaint Program, Capitol Mall Evacuation Program, planning and communication to evacuation coordinators. Position also receives, records, and prepares inmate injury claims for processing, reviews agency requests for certificates of insurance and issues certificates, processes insurance billings, and operating expenses. What would happen here is we would no longer be able to support the Citizen Complaint Program. Risk management currently receives, depending on the year, anywhere from 250 to 350 citizen complaints, primarily focused on the use of state vehicles.
Mr. Chair, as a matter of fact, I made one of those complaints yesterday after my boss called me up livid because he's driving down the freeway 75 miles an hour. And a state van goes past him at least at 85, and he got the number, and I called it in. So, yeah, you'll get those kind of complaints.
Yes, we do. The next item there, we would propose as an option to keep 27 vehicles in service beyond the replacement criteria of 8 years of age or 100,000 miles. That would mean that these vehicles would be more expensive to operate. Also, I want to point out to you that 45% of the fleet currently exceeds this replacement criteria.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Quick question. Backing up to page 52, eliminating seven positions in the motor fleet, are those all maintenance positions, or are you eliminating managerial positions there also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, these would be maintenance positions. They're auto mechanic ones or laborers.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up, how come no managerial positions are being reduced there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I believe in our analysis, we believe that our management positions are appropriate for the span of control that they have. These seven positions would be between the Portland and Salem Motor Pool. They're not in one location, and if I'm not mistaken, it may also include a position in Eugene as well. So they're dispersed across all three motor pools.
With respect to the vehicles, how many are we talking about? 27 out of a pool of how many?
Mr. Chair, we have 3,700 vehicles. 45% of those currently are outside the replacement criterion. That's either more than 8 years old and they have more than 100,000 miles. So let's see, 45% of 3,700 would be around, 1,400 vehicles, something like that. So you'd have 27 of that 1,500 vehicles that would continue in service longer. But there'll be other option packages that will add to that number.
And Mr. Chair, just a quick side note on this issue. Some years ago, I think in 99, when Cam Burney was heading up this effort, we discussed the whole issue of state motor pool and fleets and this issue of older and older cars and how they get more expensive to maintain over time. And the choices are sort of clear. We've never been able to accomplish this, but we could do like other states do and make a one-time major purchase of automobiles that are relatively new or are brand new and cycle them every year or 2 years in a program with the car manufacturers like some states do. Some states actually make a profit, believe it or not, on doing that. Because they buy with other states in these huge blocks of automobiles, and those are the program cars that come back to us that go on the car lots for sale. But it takes a large infusion of cash up front to get to that point to begin with. And this was all centering around the discussion of whether we should look at privatizing our state motor pool, renting out, or making it at least a break-even proposition in how we operate it. And it was an interesting discussion to look at the numbers, but the key thing is that the older these fleets get, the more they cost us in maintenance over time.
We need to keep moving.
Okay. Next option is on page 54. We would eliminate a claims specialist position. This would be an entry-level claims adjuster position that handles a high volume of claims from foster parents, inmates, and less complex agency property claims. These claims would be distributed to the remaining adjusters, which would slow our processing of all claims. The next item identifies an additional 32 vehicles that we would keep in service beyond the replacement schedule. The next page, the option would include an elimination of another claims representative. This is not an entry-level adjuster, but it's a low-level adjuster. Again, has a high volume of claims. These claims would be spread amongst the remaining adjusters. This will reduce the ability to promptly contact claimants and seek resolution. It's likely to increase our costs. Increased caseload for adjusters also would reduce their ability to identify and address more serious claims. The next option is another 5 vehicles to keep beyond the replacement timeline. The next option on page 56 would be to eliminate a position in the risk safety and risk consulting unit. It would reduce our ability to partner with agencies to identify and mitigate risk and workplace complaints. It would slow resolution of workplace issues and the elimination of risk. And the last item, we would retain 130 vehicles beyond the replacement criteria. And with that, I'll conclude, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Next, State Comptroller's Division, John Redford, please.
Good morning. I'm John Radford, State Comptroller, State Comptroller's Division, Department of Administrative Services. The State Comptroller's Division, I'll start right in on page 3, program overview. We operate the statewide payroll and the statewide accounting system. These are common system investments that are made across state government to provide a common platform for processing payroll and accounting transactions. On the payroll side, we do about 45,000 payments a month. In the accounting system, we make about 50,000 vendor payments per month. We develop control policies and procedures and systems, try to strive for data that's integrated, high integrity, reliable. On the control policy area, you think about Sarbanes-Oxley and what's happening in the private sector. We're trying to provide those controls necessary to ensure data that's reliable and high integrity. We produce accurate and timely financial statements. We're the people that put together the and compile the financial statements for the state. This is a document that's used primarily by Oregon investors, people who are investing in Oregon bonds and the investment community. We also provide small agency accounting and budget services. Under mission and goals on page 5, our mission is to try to support and ensure accuracy and accountability in state government through the management of financial systems that provide related services and controls for statewide accounting, receivables, financial reporting, and payroll functions. And you can kind of see on the bottom of page 5 there some of the statutory references, primarily 291 series and some of the 293 series. On page 6, our goals, of course, are to coordinate across the state agencies for common cross-cutting, cross-agency financial management initiatives. We strive to provide strong financial policies and procedures to help document internal controls across the state, provide planned and effective central financial systems. This is, of course, to aggregate and manage supply and demand at the right level so that we're making common investment systems, not duplicating systems across state agencies. And, of course, to provide credible and reliable statewide financial data. On page 7, we'll start some goal statements. And I've mentioned systems, data, and financial reports meeting national accounting standards. These are the standards that we have to comply with under national board called the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, and those standards help us stay consistent and produce credible financial statements. We also, of course, are interested in providing compliance with state laws, number of ORSs, for example, federal laws, and we're very interested in compliance with respect to federal and state regulations. For example, our accounting system is built such that we're providing the core basic set of compliance for appropriations, for example. We provide professional training, guidance, and customer support. Untrained and high turnover leads to errors and rework. And, of course, we want to minimize that as much as possible. And, of course, provide convenient customer access to financial data. Before we get into organizational charts, I just want to give you a little bit of a historical perspective. In 1985, the state implemented a payroll system, new payroll system. So the payroll system that we're currently operating under was designed and developed in the first part of the 1980s. That was implemented in 1985, so in effect we're currently operating a 20-year-old statewide payroll system. Our statewide accounting system was built and constructed in the early 90s and started implementation in 1995. We completed that implementation in 1997. Our shared client services, the group that provides budget and accounting services to about 25 small agencies, was transferred in 1995 to the when there was a combination of DGS, the old Department of General Services operation, and the Executive Department. We became the Department of Administrative Services. Those small services to those small agencies were transferred to the Internal Service Division, and then in 1995. And in 1997, we implemented a data warehouse. That warehouse we put on financial data. That's a online, it's a week-old data. We update the warehouse weekly for cost savings, and that provides online access to the state agencies to our financial information. In 2001, we added payroll data to that, so the agencies have an online way to access payroll data. In 1999, that shared client services group that provides small agency accounting and budget services transferred back to the State Controller's Division in a minor reorganization, again, in 1999. In 2000, we added accounts receivable. This was a result of an audit in 1997, indicating that we should probably provide some centralized direction, focus, management, control, coordination, if you will, for statewide accounts receivable. That position was added in 2000. And in 2001, the state began an e-government program, and a part of that e-government program was a desire to add e-commerce transactions to the state. And so we've been able to support the IRMD's e-commerce e-government initiative by providing some financial support in that area for e-commerce. So that's kind of a historical perspective of the division. The organizational chart on page 9, 0305, and the organizational chart on page 10, 0507, is basically unchanged, with the exception of a package, which I'll talk about, I guess, in phase 2, which will is a half a FTE to provide some additional agencies to our small agency accounting and budgeting section. Basically, we have five divisions, and I'll talk about those in detail in a minute. Statewide accounting and reporting, we have shared client services, which again is that small agency accounting thing. Statewide financial services, some statewide financial management services group, which is basically our system, and then Oregon statewide payroll services. And you can kind of see those the distribution of FTE there. We have currently two FTE in job rotation status. One is with our statewide financial services unit, and that position is probably going to be hired today or tomorrow on a full-time basis. And then we have a job rotation in our statewide payroll services unit. And before I start in on page 12, which is starts our dialogue on our individual sections within our division, I just wanted to go over quickly customers and stakeholders. State employees, for example, is a customer base. We do the payroll for them. State agencies, we provide accounting system and policies to those folks. Federal agencies are involved in reporting and compliance with federal regulations. Our investment community, I mentioned, are very interested in our annual financial statements. Treasury, which handles the banking relationships for the state, our budget management division, purchasing system, which you just heard this morning, and our human resources, we operate an integrated accounting system which is integrated with their system. So we're passing information back and forth almost on a daily basis with those systems. The audits division is another stakeholder group involved with us in terms of financial reporting and compliance. And then our internal auditors who are out in the field with the agencies that hopefully are monitoring our policies, compliance with our policies and procedures. So they're kind of our internal control field office, if you will. On page 12, division administration, that's a small unit providing leadership, management, communications, customer relations, support, direction for the division. On page 13, that's our statewide financial management services unit. They own and operate the business side of our statewide financial system. So they're involved in internal controls and security and access. They provide operational control system policies and processes and procedures, guidance to the agencies. We provide business systems management, improvements to system functionality, for example, managing data, trying to figure out ways to minimize our data costs and make system enhancements. We provide training and support for the statewide accounting system. Obviously, there's agencies out there in turnover, accountants, new accountants coming in that need training and education on how the system works, how to navigate the system, how to get reports out of the system, that kind of thing. In terms of related services, we provide setup and changes advice to the agencies who are sometimes in a state of reorganization or program reorganization. We do 1099s. We resolve system issues. We have about 100-plus interface files that are coming into our system, so we manage those interface files. Obviously, compliance. Also compliance with terrorist laws.
Define interface file.
Interface file is where you might have a subsystem out there at an agency that is providing financial information to our core accounting system. So, for example, I'll just use as an example Judicial Department. Judicial Department has a subsystem with a case management system. They run accounts receivables out there, but we acquire their it doesn't make sense for us to have a statewide system for managing that narrow kind of functionality for case management in the judicial side. So they provide us an interface file for those receivable information. So that would be an example. We have about 100-plus of those kinds of interface files around the state. We also, before we make disbursements, have to comply with the federal requirement for, forget the term, but it's anti-terrorism. So the feds maintain a list of bad people that are involved in terrorist activities, and before we make a payment, we have to run our file against their file to make sure that we're not making a disbursement of funds to a known or suspected terrorist kind of a thing.
That's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Showed up on payroll.
Yeah.
We also have a couple of years ago, we told you that we were starting a contract with PRG Schultz Incorporated. They're a company that goes around and analyzes disbursement activity for recovery of erroneous payments or duplicate payments or that kind of thing. They've been on board with us now for 2 years. They only get paid if they make a collection, and so we have no other cost associated with this. They take a cut, 30-35% of the recovery dollars that they actually collect. They have to actually have the cash in hand before they take a cut. So far, they've collected for the state $700,000. They've recovered for the state $700,000. We've paid them $235,000 to recover that $700,000. And the logical question is, well, how much did they review to get that $700,000? And they've reviewed over $12 billion worth of expenditures. They have very sophisticated proprietary software. They have a large database down in Atlanta, Georgia. And primarily this is an on-site person that collects data off of our systems, run the files down to Atlanta. Atlanta does a lot of data analysis on it with a lot of sophisticated proprietary software tools. Feed that information back to their on-site staff person here who goes out and does the collection. That makes sense?
Go back over that again. This is a private agency that...
Private firm.
That you've hired.
We've hired.
A private firm to collect precisely what?
Erroneous payments.
Erroneous
payments.
Okay.
For example, somebody, somehow the system, some internal control breakdown, and somebody got an extra payment. And their software catches a lot of those things. There could be lots of different reasons. There's a laundry list of some 20 or 25 things that can happen. Contract payments that got through twice, didn't really conform to the contract, that kind of thing. Discount, just errors. And they go out and identify these things, they make the collection, they bring the cash back to the state. Once we get the cash, we pay them a percentage.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you share with me, what's the turnaround time of an invoice from a contractor to the state of Oregon?
Well, that varies agency by agency, depending upon the complexity of the payment, of course. Sometimes you have a very complex payment associated with a very complex contract. Once that invoice is received, that has to go through the agency analysis and review process. Sometimes there's information that's missing, and they have to call the vendor to get the information in. They do a lot of analysis on very complex contracts. So that could be up to 30, 35, 40 days in some cases. Most, however, probably go within the first 10 or 15 days.
The reason I ask that question is I work with a lot of small business owners who do business with the state of Oregon, and probably one of the biggest concerns I hear is that the state it takes a while to get those processed, and effectively it's detrimental to the cash flow of the small business owner who's trying to work with a state but at the same time has zero leverage to get that cash. And so I don't know what to do on it, but at the same time, I hope there's a sensitivity to realize.
Of course, and certainly, and from the time that the invoice hits the fiscal shop, it's usually within, I'm going to say maybe 10 days.
Okay.
But it's going through the programmatic review.
Got it.
That's out there to make certain that this is a valid payment, that it meets the criteria that we've established, that it conforms to the contract, those kinds of things, before it even gets to the fiscal shop. Once it hits the fiscal shop, it's usually pre-audited and paid within, I'm going to say, 10 days. For example, in our small agency accounting, we usually turn around those invoices within 3.5 days. So the bottleneck is probably more in the program side.
One more quick question on the private firm that does the duplicate or erroneous collections. The you said they collected about $700,000 on $12 million roughly.
$12 billion.
$12 billion. Okay.
$12 billion.
So these are they look at basically all of the expenses
all the expenses that we've made vendor payments on.
Vendor payments. Okay.
Yeah, not necessarily
okay.
Payroll side.
Right. Side. Vendor payments. Okay.
And so we give them a data dump. They come in with a template of what data they need. We map that template to our data, and then we send them a file, and then that data they send down to Atlanta, and then that starts their process.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chair. How come you can't just send them a letter and say we sent you too much money?
That's what they do.
How come we can't? The state of Oregon.
Well, we think out of $12 billion, only $700,000.
That's awesome.
We have tremendous good controls in place to prevent duplicate payments and errors. We're very astounded at this number.
If they're a vendor of the
state of Oregon. Well, we don't even know it. That's the thing. We don't know it.
Got it.
Somebody in the agency doesn't know it.
Got it.
And something happened. Some anomaly happened. Some error happened. And these folks have very sophisticated years and years of developed software that we don't have access to, and I don't think they probably want to give it to us. And that's how they're making their money. They've developed this. They've probably put in millions of dollars into develop this particular proprietary software and a huge database. They do this in the private sector quite a bit. And so they're just matching that up with us. And they're the ones that are, it's really like hunting for needles in a haystack. They're applying the resource. And if they're unsuccessful, they don't get paid. If they're successful, they have a high motivation here,
sure.
Then they get paid.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
That's good stuff. That's very good stuff.
Okay, the next slide, page 14, just shows we told you that we were starting to move our paper-based warrants, our checks, if you will, that's a kind of a technical term, our checks from paper-based to electronic. This was under development in 2002 and 2003. We implemented in late 2003. And in 2004, this is the numbers we're getting. We're starting to move from paper-based to electronic. Okay? This is like direct deposit, like you get your check. Okay. Page 15 is a control service example. A lot of people don't understand what are controls, you know, when you have your processes and procedures and systems in place. Here's an example. Where in 2001 and 2002, we started to develop an automated way to help us on general fund reconciliation. So in the past, it took us 20 days to do the general fund reconciliation. In 2003, we got it down to about seven and a half days. In 2004, we're down to 5 days. Okay, so this is kind of an example of a control. Page 16, we're moving to another section now within our division, Statewide Accounting Reporting Services. These are the folks that are essentially involved in policy and interpreting governmental accounting standards for financial reporting. They're the ones that are putting our financial statements together, so they're responsible for state and federal fiscal compliance. For example, federal grants, statewide cost allocation is another requirement that the feds have. We share cost together, for example. Interpret generally accepted accounting principles. This is the Governmental Accounting Standards Board I mentioned. Develops and maintains statewide accounting policies and procedures. For example, cash disbursement controls. This gets to the controls that we have around about making cash disbursements so that we don't end up with a lot of erroneous payments. Prepares and publishes Oregon Annual Financial Report, and we provide system security administration. We want to make sure that we don't have access given to too many parts of our system so someone could collude our system or commit fraud. So we're kind of managing that centrally. Next slide on page 17 is Oregon Statewide Payroll Services. We own and manage the statewide payroll system. This, of course, is we have to meet federal and state laws, bargaining agreement requirements, that kind of thing. We provide operational control and system policies. We maintain the system. We identify issues and resolve system anomalies and system issues. Provide business systems management and improvements. We manage, for example, when we systematize changes that come in from federal changes in federal and state laws, workers' comp laws, for example, PERS, for example, and benefits. Those changes are required to be made in the system for meeting payroll. We provide training and support statewide on the payroll system. We manage a small user group across the state, and we provide related services. Again, we have some interface files coming into the payroll side. We do federal and state reporting, for example, quarterly reporting required by the feds, 1099s, that kind of thing, 1098s. And we also have data warehouse. We have our payroll data on the data warehouse. On page 18, this has been a long time. A goal of ours is to reduce the amount of paper checks, and you can kind of see a distribution there from 98 to 2004. We're continuing to make progress, but as you get a higher and higher percentage converted to direct deposit, progress becomes more problematic. Even a lot of companies that have a goal of 100% of their employees on direct deposit find it difficult to achieve 90%. So we're at about 80-some percent right now, 82, 83%. We've been working on it. Shared client services, this is the on page 19 now. This is the group that's providing accounting and budgeting services to 25 small agencies in the governor's office. And it's just basically processing financial transactions, providing some fiscal oversight, doing some training and records management. We process their accounts payable transactions, for example. We provide budget preparation and other management kind of services, allotment services, for example, some oversight, meeting with the managers and discussing their financial performance, where they are in their budget, that kind of thing. And we prepare financial statements and provide ad hoc reporting to those agencies through the data warehouse application. On page 20, you can kind of see the agencies that we're servicing in this area. Page 20, it's just a list of our agencies in that area. On page 21, Statewide Financial Services. This is a group that's involved in accounts receivable. We manage the collection contracts These are the groups that are assisting state agencies in managing their, being more aggressive on their receivables, that kind of thing, trying to improve our revenue picture. They're involved in monitoring and some reporting in that area, setting policy, working with the agencies and with the contractors. We set direction for statewide financial internal control compliance. This is policies, processes, and procedures. We work with state agencies on control issues. For example, we've had to go out with a couple of agencies where we've noticed some problems and issues. We go out and meet with them, talk about internal controls, and try to improve those processes and procedures out there. And lastly, we provide some policy coordination, training, and business controls for the statewide e-commerce initiative. Support IRMD on, with business knowledge. They're basically on the technical side. We're trying to provide and support them on the business side. On page 22, you can kind of see the growth in e-commerce transactions. It's pretty impressive as the IRMD folks are adding more and more agencies and more business applications, and I think this is the future. You're going to see more and more paper-based transactions move to electronic transactions. This is kind of indicative of where the world is going. So on page 24...
Except the legislature.
On page 24, we're going to get into some performance measures here. Two performance measures here that are linked to the benchmark process. These are inverted here. You can kind of see the first chart is the number of years out of the last five the State Controllers Division earns GFOA Certificate of Excellence in Financial Reporting. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but those that's a huge process that we go through. There's a huge checklist that we answer. We send all of this to Chicago. That's the headquarters of the Government Finance Office Association. They take all of our financial data, our financial reports, our disclosures, our checklists, and they farm that out to three independent people nationwide. Those three independent people grade us on our financial statements, and then we get the grade back. And if we meet the grade, then we get a national certificate for compliance. That makes sense? So there's a lot embedded in there. Included, we have to have a clean opinion from the state auditors on our financial statements. So if we don't get that, we're not going to get this either. So it's kind of an inclusive kind of process.
What does it cost? What does it cost to do all of that work to get that?
$1,000.
What?
$1,000 is the fee that we pay to Government Finance Officers Association.
What does it cost in staff time to prepare all the information to send in?
I'm going to say a couple of days. We have all of the information. Now it takes us 6 months to produce a financial statement. Working with the agencies in the Secretary of State's Audits Division to get to a financial statement. We close the books on July 1, and we don't get a financial statement out till around the first of the year. And that's normal. Almost, I'd say 80% of the states take about 6 months to get a financial statement out. I start getting statements filtered to me about the middle of December, and they're still coming in. Okay? The chart below that is percentage of agencies earning State Controllers Division Gold Star Certificate. That is a program that we started a number of years ago to try to, in a positive way, encourage agencies to comply with our policies and procedures with respect to the financial statement, the financial information that we acquire from the state agencies, and the disclosure. So we feel pretty good about that. We're up to around the 95 percentile. If we maintain between 90% and 95% compliance out there, we're doing pretty good with the agencies. It's a huge effort to put together a financial statement for the state. Page 26, percentage of respondents to department-wide performance satisfaction. Our target is 85%, and at least in 2003 we had 89%. Our prioritized list for cuts to meet the requirement there. Let me just take a few minutes and explain how we prioritize. In the fiscal arena, we are really good at triaging and prioritizing, if we have to, even on a monthly, weekly, or daily basis. And keep in mind also that to a certain extent, our assets are fungible. For example, we can assign accountant 2 or accountant 3 duties to an accountant 4. It would be a little more difficult to assign accountant 4 duties to an accountant 2. It would be difficult to take payroll people and put them in our more technical accounting environment to do financial statements. So to a certain extent, we have some fungibility with respect to our assets, but we are limited as well. But in our criteria, we look first to the regulatory environment. So just to give an example, state and federal laws. So state accounting, budgeting, payroll, PERS, collective bargaining, and labor statutes. Those are statutory requirements that we must meet. Payroll withholding and employee payments, for example, would be a high priority. Payroll reporting, making sure that we're producing W-2s, making quarterly and federal reports, state and federal reports. Cost allocation is a requirement under OMB. Single Audit Act is a requirement under OMB. Federal Office of Management and Budget, that's a federal entity. And then federal financial data and reports. So those in a regulatory under state and federal law. National accounting standards, policies, methods, processes, procedures, and systems designed to ensure compliance. State financial statements and disclosure would be a high priority. Our second layer then would be contractual obligations. Labor agreements, bond covenants, for example, we have a lot of requirements to meet when we do financial statements to meet bond covenants. Federal agreements such as OMB settlements, private collection contracts, these are accounts receivable and management collection areas. Bank contracts, for example, credit card rules, direct deposit rules, meeting those kinds of requirements, and then any interagency agreements. Our third area would be data integrity and reliability. So mandatory system changes in systems, for example, accounting rules that are changed on us, or state audit recommendations, or just simply ongoing maintenance to preserve the integrity of the system. Accounting and payroll system controls, new system edits, for example, that have been identified by audit recommendations. Accounts receivable e-commerce controls, system interfaces, reconciliations, and research anomalies would be another area under that area. SCD reconciliations and verifications. For example, we monitor the system daily. It's kind of a dynamic environment we're in with up to 1,500 to 2,000 people processing transactions on our systems. We have to be able to monitor the integrity of those transactions that are being processed.
Just a very quick question. In the banking industry, senior management is required to take at a minimum 7 days off, consecutive days off, and leave. Do we have that same requirement of our top managers?
Representative Smith, Mr. Chair, no. We do not have a requirement for we encourage that. That's part of a good and control environment. But we don't have a requirement of vacation leaves or anything of that nature.
Would you, just a quick follow-up, would you mind coming and visiting with me and letting me know what the statutory repercussions would be? Or the repercussions if a statute was introduced that would require top management to leave for 1 week?
Representative Smith, we should certainly meet with you on that.
Thank you.
Up to 1 week.
They do a good job. Yes. We just want to protect the state of Oregon.
Yes, that's our goal.
That's right.
And then finally, we're involved, and that third criteria is prioritizing security access controls. We want to make sure that we don't give unauthorized access to somebody who has too much access who can easily commit a fraud. We want to make that very, very difficult. Fourth area would be general management and services, for example, help desk and user support, agency training, and then discretionary policy research and development, for example, best practices, recommendations from national associations, and state audit recommendations. In those areas, that would be discretionary. That would be a lower priority. And then finally, efficiency and effective investments, discretionary changes in accounting and payroll systems, discretionary non-system changes, for example, processes and methods, improvements in processes, methods, and procedures, and then on-site agency reviews and other requests for assistance. So that kind of gives you a scale of how we would prioritize our criteria. Prioritized list on page 28 is a request to provide for you our programmatic, if you will, kind of prioritization. First, it would be administration. Second would be statewide payroll services. We have to get people paid. You've never seen a political problem until you've not paid 37,000 employees. Statewide financial management services, that would be a system issue. Of course, we've got to get people paid. Vendors got to get paid. Statewide accounting and reporting would be next, then statewide financial services, and then shared client services. Those would be our support to small agencies and budget. Under our 10% House Bill 3182 reduction options, our order would be to eliminate an office specialist. This would shift the general office work to the accountants or to the payroll professionals. We would eliminate an accountant four position, and that position right now is supporting e-commerce. We would eliminate a one position out of small agencies, which would either require the small agency to acquire their own accounting and budgeting services or outsource that. And I can tell you these services are provided at a significant discount to the market. And if they were to outsource that, that would be fine with us, but I'm sure it would require an additional 30% to 50% in cost at minimum. We would eliminate four positions in the statewide financial management system, and that would be primarily in the system management area, maybe some in the agency support arena. We would eliminate one position in our statewide accounting and reporting unit, and this would provide reduced payroll and financial system security assistance. Because their time would be spent mostly on preparing financial statements, and then eliminate one position in the Oregon State payroll system. So with that would conclude our phase one presentation on the State Controller's Division. I'd be happy to answer questions.
I have just one question. It seems like you were reading a lot of your internal priorities that we don't have. Is that?
Yes, I did not put that in a slide, but I can certainly duplicate that for you.
Is that something? Is that an overload on us? Is that why you didn't give it to us?
No, that was something I put together the last couple of days as we looked at the slides, and just thought I'd mention that to give you some more clarity about how we would go through that kind of mental process to look at our priorities and make some cuts.
Good.
No, it's just quite simple. We have got to get our people paid. Yeah, we have got to get a financial statement out. We've got bond covenants that we've got to meet. For example, if we don't get our financial statement out by January 1st, nothing's going to happen.
Well, I'm interested in the long list that you went through of your internal priorities. Yeah, that's what I'm
okay. We can certainly get that for you, sir.
So we understand in your order of priority here on the reductions, the first reduction you would take would be the office specialist.
It would be a clerical position.
Correct. And then you go down the list.
We go down the list.
Any other questions or comments?
Good job.
Thank you.
All right, John. Thank you.
John. We have 6 minutes. Shall we make use of the 6 minutes? Okay, let's move forward. Start. Bill Foster.
Well, Bill's coming up, Chair, members of the committee. The passed around replacement for facilities division, House Bill 31, the 10% cut. So if you would be able to go right in the back of the facilities division section to replace that, which is there. Or you can leave it in your books and we can do it afterward. But I just wanted to point that out.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Foster. I'm the acting administrator of the facilities division of the Department of Administrative Services. And I would like to start by just giving a little bit of context for the facilities division and what we do. Oregon University System is, in fact, the state's largest owner of properties and owns more space than all of the other agencies combined. When you separate that out, then we're talking about part of what's left. The department manages and provides coordination of state's facilities. It's one of 20 other agencies that own and manage facilities. We own approximately 3.2 million of the state's 14.3 million square feet of major buildings. We provide services to 3.9 million of those of that area, and we negotiate leases for about 4 million square feet. The next slide, page 6. In 1999, ORS 276-227 directed DAS to coordinate some facility inventory and planning process for all state-owned property, again, not counting the university system. The university system was granted independence from a number of procurement and other statutes by legislation. And so of the non-university system, we have about a fifth of the property. Moving on to slide 7, our customers are listed here as to basically it's the tenants of the buildings and the people we provide services for. Slide 8 is a historical perspective. The facilities division provides, you know, the support of the functions of government. most of the functions that are there predate the merge of General Services of the Executive Department in 1993. And the last piece that was really significant that was added was the statewide facilities program was transferred from budget management in 1999. On page 11, our mission is to provide and operate state facilities in a manner that maximizes and protects the state's investment and meets the needs of the state. And the statutory authority is predominantly in Chapter 276 with some other areas of 270 and 279. Goals is to provide state facilities to conform with legislated and gubernatorial policy, to keep costs below private sector charges for comparable services. Our organizational chart for 03, 05, and 05, 07 is basically the same, with the exception that four FTE are being added in support of a new facility that's under construction or in the planning and construction process in the Portland area. Going through our programs and services, it's comprised of real property services, operations and maintenance, parking, project management, statewide services, and facilities administration. Starting with real...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Bill, approximately how many of your 205 FTEs would be essentially dedicated to OUS facilities?
Mr. Chairman, none.
None.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
They are totally independent of okay. anything we do.
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are community colleges included in your FTEs, or are they separate also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bakken, they are separate also.
Okay.
So what we're really talking about is the facilities that support the major part of state government, like on the Capitol Mall. The real property services program has seven FTE and range private and state-owned office building leases. We lease, as I said before, $4 million, and there's an error here. This should be $3.2 that we own.
Bill, if it would be possible.
Sure.
I think we'll conclude the hearing today.
Okay.
Some of us have obligation at 10:30. And I assume you're available to return tomorrow and water. Okay. We'll do that. And hearing objections.
Okay.
Hearing's closed.
You want